Okay, so welcome everyone to compiler construction today. Last time we talked about the shift-reduce parser and how to force it to actually really reduce when it's useful to reduce in order to reach the root node of such a parse tree, and when to actually do shifting. We have had several concepts to support that for once we were following the idea of analyzing the content of the shift-reduce parser's stack with the help of a canonical automaton in order to get a first clue about what to do or not. Then we realized that this was still too weak for meaningful grammars, so we extended the concept with a look-ahead window into the input that still remains to be parsed, and with that we managed to parse quite a significant amount of grammars. So after we were done with that, we established how to build an LR1 parser out of the things that we have gathered so far, and then continued with the topic of what to do in case of conflicts or even ambiguous definitions of grammars. This led us to the definition of precedences for particular operators, and with that we finished with this slide where we talked about what to do in case that precedences are not the way that we can work with the grammar due to maybe the operator acting differently in different contexts. So, what can we do apart from these precedences? Well, an example where that plays a role, you might ask, where do we get that from? And, well, turns out that with the ongoing trend of putting lambda expressions in just about everything that there is, there's a lot of these constructs showing up in grammars for different languages. So this is an excerpt of, I think it originally came from the Java grammar, where lambda expressions were added from one version to another. So this was an excerpt of what was added to that. And I've stripped away almost everything that that is relevant for Java, just focusing on the actual lambda expressions, because this was one of the reasons why the Java grammar wouldn't be accepted by an LR1 parser anymore. So why might that be? Each time that we ask ourselves whether something is possibly of a particular LRK class or not, we will usually look at all the different derivations that we can do on these production sets, and then decide whether we can disambiguate the last step of expansion that we did or not. And this can also be done for this grammar, and well, we see that things that can be constructed from that is, for example, the ones that you see here. So you can create something like this sequence by just going the zeroth alternative for the E production and then going to an identifier. So this is just a brackets around an identifier that's a valid expression in Java. Then what else you can do is, well, you can go, for example, into the lambda world directly from E by going alternative 2. There you get to specify args, then a mapping arrow and another expression, probably. The args will then go to, for example, the brackets with the identifier list, while the identifier list then can be brought to an ident in the end, which will lead you to this filler over here. And if you look at that through the magnifying glass of whether that corresponds to a certain LRK type or not, you might be interested in a few special spots of the whole thing, particularly what follows the last sequence of symbols that had been produced in the last derivation step. And these are the things that I have underlined in red on in this enumeration here. And you see that for the first one, you get a closing bracket. For the second one, you get a closing bracket, and then followed by a mapping arrow. And it turns out, well, that for the whole thing to be an LR one grammar, you would have to be able to disambiguate between both of these cases just based on the next symbol following the last expanded sequence that occurred in there. So the green things need to be disambiguated by the first symbol. Turns out, well, in our case, the first symbol is actually really matching with each other. So this is a bad thing for LR1, so a typical LR1 parser generator, as there are many out there, will probably refuse to work with such an example. So this is then, well, for our purposes, an LR2 parser would suffice because, well, with the next symbol in this, you would probably already know which of, or you will definitely know whether you are in the branch of, well, just bracketed expressions or lambda expressions. Yeah. So there are several options that you can do there. Either you can switch to larger K, but, well, this needs the right tooling, and depending on the language in which you want to embed your parser with a generator, you are restricted to the tools that are actually available for that platform. So, and I can definitely say you there are LRK or general LRK parsers out there, but there are not many of them, and not for each and every language environment. So depending on which area you want to use your generated parser in, well, you might be screwed, because the LR1 parsers are the largest group that is out there. K larger than 1 is not so widely used. So, well, what can you do then? Well, the only thing that could be done then would be probably something like trying to rewrite the grammar in a particular way such that you can circumvent having to decide your handle with two tokens and go to just the next token to be decisive for what path you should take. So, you can now start playing around with that in an uncoordinated manner, or you could, for example, in that case, go into a particular idea of saying, well, these are two tokens that I could, for example, see related in that particular context, since those brackets here are very special brackets that are used together with this arrow thing to build these lambda expressions. So I could, for example, think about joining the closing bracket with the mapping operator into just one terminal symbol, get that delivered by the scanner, and then just work a little bit with the productions, maybe inline the this arcs brackets into the place during the lambda production, where into the place in the lambda expression where it is actually used, and then just fuse them together, and with that you could just use one symbol to disambiguate with the other symbol from before. So that would be kind of the trick that you can use for that particular thing. But the question is, how do you turn that into a thing that you can do regularly? And actually, combining tokens with each other is just a very particular special case. But what really is interesting is to the idea behind to play around with the place where the actual terminals are found in there. So in our case, we just move them to a little bit closer to together, and maybe this leads to a situation where we can circumvent these LR2 states. So turns out that this is a thing that has been of high demand since there. Well, nowadays it seems that people don't care so much about formulating your grammar in a way that it is actually fitting to the particular parser generator tool, but more like in a readable fashion and more feature oriented than parser generator oriented. So having support for languages that are LRKs probably a good idea. The example would be for in our case this Java 1.6, for example, which has these particular patterns that drive us into an LRK greater than 1. So this would be of high interest. And well, of course, you can still think about moving to the LR2 or LR3 parser or some general LRK parser, but you always have to keep in mind that when you have a look-ahead larger than one, of course, also all the you need to gather for these look-ahead sequences of tokens that are longer than one. They are 2, 3, 4, whatever k you choose here, and with that you get all the combinations that are possible for terminals as valid look-ahead sequences. And well, this is an exponentially growing mass of look-aheads that you might have to gather for that, and you might probably not want to blow up your look-ahead set computation all too much. So is there alternatives out there? And well, turns out that there is one particular nice thing out there, which is the idea of Schneider and Mikunas here, that give us ideas of how to transform grammar into an equivalent grammar that is parsable with an LR with a K that is lower than before. You can iteratively repeat that until you reach a grammar that is parsable with an LR1 grammar. So this gives you a transformation from any LRK to an LR1 grammar by just rewriting the grammar and then reuse your plain old LR1 parser generator. And well, let's have a look how this might work. So another example here, where you maybe not immediately see what you could do in order to get rid of the LR2 states in there, is this one here. So, well, we could now start with enumerating all the possible derivations. I've done that for you so that you don't have to do that online now. So these are the the derivations that I would focus on. And you see, if you look at those, that, for example, here and here, just by looking at the first symbol after the handle, you cannot decide whether they are different or not. Adding another symbol then differentiates them from each other. So two symbols after the handle are necessary for those. So this is LR2, this example. So with LR1, you would have reduced conflicts between productions A1 and B1 under B. So these are the reductions that belong to this handle. So these are those two. And if you just see a look ahead of B, then you can't really decide whether to reduce to A or whether you reduce to B. So since this is this look ahead of B does not really help, but is following this this A by production that is very much higher up in the hierarchy, you could think about having this B over here in the grammar is maybe not such a good idea for parsing with LR1. If we could somehow make sure that this B is produced by that A thing, for example, or the B thing itself instead of here, then the whole situation might change. So the idea would be to rewrite the grammar and to pull out the Bs from here and push them into whatever the production for A or for B looks like, and to add them kind of in the end of whatever A and B would produce anyway. So this is kind of the general idea that is behind there. So instead of having the decisive terminal symbol that tells us whether to reduce with A, reduce to A or to B in the second position after our current decision, the idea would be to move the intermediate terminal that keeps us from reaching this decisive terminal with just a look ahead of one, to move that around in our derivation tree and move that to an earlier place where we are still not done with reducing either to A or to B. So this is what is done with two operations. There's the write context extraction that pulls this symbol X, you know, that is in the way of deciding A or B, up to a node that is parent node of as well this X as well as the production in question, so that it resides there, and then to push it back down with the right context propagation to the production right hand side that is in question of being reduced or not. So these two phases would have to be performed in order to get rid of this X that blocks our way to reach this decisive Y. So in our example, what would that mean, what we have to do? The one thing that we see here in this production is that the common parent for the B as well as the this A production or B production that is in reduced conflict under this B is already reached with this S. So we have in this grammar already a situation like there where the X is already a direct child of the parent of both. So this means for our case that B is a child of S, And S is also apparent for this A thing that is in conflict under B. So the right context extraction doesn't really need to happen. Instead, all we need to do is this right context propagation, meaning that we have to only have to move this X down there. So how can we do that? Well, for that purpose, we start rewriting the grammar by introducing new symbols. And as similar to what we have done for this grammar rewriting in the write regular languages, I think it was. Well, anyway, similar to that, we introduce new non-terminals with these green brackets. And we, within these green brackets, we choose as names verbose titles, like this means that the B is intended to be already pushed down into whatever A expands to. So instead of having a non-terminal A and terminal B, we replace that with this new terminal and the rest of that thing, which is just this B, and we repeat the same thing for the other alternative. But we push that B, that lowercase b, into the uppercase b, and to do so, we replace that with this new non-terminal bb. Now we have to say how those look like, and well, they look like you see over here. For example, for this ab, you see that the b has already been transported back into this alternative. It also has been transported there, but having a B directly following an A is, well, you can again apply the same transformation and reuse this non-terminal AB to come to this thing. Otherwise, you would just have the same conflict as before on another level. So, yeah, you repeat that and replace this AB thing with this new AB. And in the same way, you handle with this BB. So you push the B into each of these productions end to come to this AB, and here this ABB. And this is again the same case as it has been before. This has to be replaced with this BB thing. And well, what then remains is that there's still the old productions A go to whatever and B go to whatever, but turns out in the current context, A and B are not reachable anymore, so we can just throw them away and continue with this grammar here. So this is a pretty quick example where we just have one level to push the this terminal around, and was rather quickly done. So did that actually really help? This is the example now with those very verbose non-terminal things that we needed for the construction, now replaced with fresh variables. And, well, we could now do the same test as before, just enumerate all the derivations possible and see whether we can we now still have LR1 conflicts in there. And well, turns out that now that the B has been pushed into the handle itself, it is now part of the actual handle, and we can now decide by just looking at what has earlier been a symbol that was two positions away from the handle. It's now just one position away, and we can directly look at that with a look ahead of one, and then have the and then directly decide that, because the other handle that looks the same is followed by a C now. So this has gotten rid of the LR1 conflict that you had before, and LR1 is for these cases sufficient to parse this grammar. So by just rewriting our grammar a little bit, we could get rid of the actual conflict in there. So, is it always so simple? Let's have a look. As another example, which looks pretty short, it just is just consists of one grammar and three alternatives, and there's not so many non-terminals occurring in there. Turns out that if you try the try out the rightmost derivations, then there is actually it's at least LR2. For example, for this one here, to differentiate that with this thing, you have to go at least two positions in front in order to disambiguate them with each other. So, yeah, this is at least LR2. And the actual shift-reduce conflicts that you get, if you put that into a parser generator, will tell you that they look like this. So this particular production is in shift-reduce conflict under the symbol A. So the idea would then be to look at the right contexts of S and then make sure that every A that follows the whole thing, because L, A is the look-ahead symbol under which the whole thing is conflicting, to pull that out from its context and push it down into whatever S is expanded to. So, in the case of this particular grammar, well, turns out that the A, for example, is not directly occurring in the right context of S, but is hidden within, well, another incarnation of S. How could we handle that? Well, we have to pull out the A from the S then. So how that is done is you look at all the productions that are expanded from S. These are these three here, and look at the ones that start with an A. So that's these two, for example. Those two are able to spit out an A. So this is what is done here. So the 8 is extracted from the S, and the S is replaced with a version that says, well, I have extracted the A from S, so like this. And this is just one side of the coin. The other side would say, well, there could be other elements directly in front of S. How do they look like? And, well, this is the last alternative from here. This would mean that B is also a valid element in front of S. So we also add this one to still catch all the possible yields of S. So, having that, we have now pulled out this A and will later on probably propagate that in into this S thingy. The only thing is now, well, how do the productions for A pulled from S or B pulled from S look like? And, well, they look like the variants that actually had these symbols, like, for example, like this, with just an epsilon, or here, missing just the first A, and that's it. The first alternative didn't provide an A, so we can't use it in that particular place. Instead, the first alternative contributes to a right-hand side for the other pulled non-terminal, this one here. And here, we have kind of introduced a similar situation as before, where an S is followed by an S, giving a right context to S, and thus we should probably pull out A and B from that, and this leads to just this transformation. And yeah, A pulled from S, B pulled from S, we have already provided those, so they should be fine now. Good. Now we have to continue with right context propagation, moving the A down into the S in order to transport them to their final destination. So this is what we've produced on the last slide. Now it is it's our purpose to push this occurrence of A down into whatever S is expanding to. So push that into the S. And for that purpose, we introduce the things that we already know, which is this S with an A added, and same thing here. And for those, we then have to add also productions that reflect that, which would be the same productions as before, just with an A added to the end. This would be this, 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 and this A. And we can, since this A is now directly following other S-like constructs, we have to iterate that, and iterate that until everything stabilizes at some point. There's certain rules that ensure that, but you see that the grammar is actually growing quite a lot. And this is the whole thing with all these non-terminals with their working titles removed and replaced with just fresh non-terminals. And you see, well, that's quite the blow-up that you get just for getting rid of this particular LR2-suited state. So, yeah, with that you can probably already guess that, well, from an algorithmic point of view, we had, earlier on, we had a problem with the original grammar, in the sense that in order to parse that with LRK, we had to compute quite long look-ahead sets, which would introduce quite the complexity due to all these combinations of symbols in sequences. We have now gotten rid of that, but we have to pay with something for that, and what we pay with is an increase in productions, which reflects the necessary effort that you would otherwise have to pay with the look-ahead set computation. So, yeah, well, you have to pay either way. It's the complexity of parsing that just doesn't go away. The only thing is that you now have your complexity in the increasing number of productions instead of the growing length of look-ahead sets. But still, you can work with your LR1 parsers and parser generators with this kind of grammar. So this is quite a benefit from that. So this might look now like a nice thing to do. However, the problem with that is now that if you began with a grammar that was quite easy to read, with such a transformation, you will get rid of everything that made the grammar readable for human beings, instead of obtaining a grammar that is suitable for LR1 parsing. This might not be a good transformation for a specification of a language, but just for an implementation of a language. So you could think about just doing these transformations right before you would actually put that into the parser generator. But for language design, doing these transformations beforehand is probably not such a particularly good idea. Also, you would probably have to think about the problem of, well, in the original the original intention was to obtain a parse tree that would be reflecting the original grammar that you had specified for that thing. Now, with such a transformed grammar, you get a completely different parse tree. So this is probably not particularly helpful. So there is ideas out there in research papers that say that with this transformation, you get a different parser than the original one, but parsing with both of them at the same time by just following the decisions that this this parser after this transformation does, you can deduce what the original parser would have decided and thus get a parse tree for the original grammar, although this was originally not doable with LR1. So this is still a helpful thing to obtain all in all. The details of what you would have to do is a thing that I don't want to shed so much light in here, because we have already lost a lot of time in parsing, so I will keep you from these things. Instead, let's sum up and continue with something different. So what we have seen in this LRK chapter is particularly in the examples here, but also in real-world languages, that there are a lot of examples that can be done with this LR1 parsing, or could even be transformed into LR1. So this LR1 seems to be kind of a major important class of grammars. What you have also seen is that if you incorporate look ahead into these LR parsing automata, then you get quite the explosion of the state space compared to the number of states that you got from the LR parser without any look ahead. So apart from the things that we have seen here with this grammar transformation, there's also ideas of defining subclasses of LRK grammars that only have as many states as the automaton without any look ahead has, which leads us to the topics of simple LRK or LALRK grammars. And these work by joining a few of the items that we would have disambiguated within the original LRK while trying to still maintain enough power to disambiguate in states so that we don't get any conflicts. This is partially successful for a few of the examples. This works quite well. So these are special cases. I don't go too much into details here. If you are interested in those, you might want to take one of the mini seminar topics. So just all in all, for parsing methods, what we have seen is, well, there's first of all the regular languages, which are quite a small core. And I just put that out here as a reference of expressibility, so that you kind of get an idea of how these parsing classes relate to each other. So on top of these regular languages, we have seen this hierarchy of LL grammars. So there's the LL1 grammars, LL2 grammars, and so on. And each of them are strictly a larger class compared to the one with the lesser look ahead. So there's a complete hierarchy of LL grammars that are strictly stronger than each other. Then what we have also seen is the LR parsing concept, particularly the LR0. This would be a class that intersects with, interestingly, a lot of these LLK grammars, but there are examples for languages that are in LR0 but not in any LLK, while there are also examples that are in some LLK but not in LR0. So they intersect, but they're not completely supersets of each other. Then there's SLRK and LALRK that are strictly larger than LR0, but all of them are dominated by the LR1 grammars. Rather go over to the concept of languages, we have seen that we can transform any deterministic language of any LRK back down onto an LRFK grammar. So in terms of languages, there is no clear hierarchy anymore. Instead, there's just the set of deterministic languages, and for all of them, doing enough transformations on the grammar itself, you can end up with a grammar that is finally an LR1 grammar. So this is why this LR1 is so particularly strong. So, yeah, that was just, again. So, summing up, all in all, what we have seen is the concept of specification and implementation being used in many contexts for the scanner specifications and the implementations, as well as the parser specifications and implementations. For lexical analysis, we have seen how to come from regular expressions to finite automata and from finite automata to scanners. For syntactical analysis, we have seen how to compute look-ahead sets and use them in order to make the item pushdown automaton into an L1 parser. We have also focused on LR parsing with the idea of helping the shift-reduce parser with a characteristic or even canonical automaton to become an LR, in our case, 1 parser. And that's that for this syntactical and lexical analysis part of the lecture. So before we now dive into the semantic analysis, last time I think I have asked you for whether you would like to join in into our mini seminar group, and this was the thing that could earn you a particular bonus on the final exam. So 13 people signed up, so I've prepared 15 topics. So there's a few spare ones, so if you don't like a particular one, you can still have another one. This would be our ideas for mini seminars. So there's a lot of different topics that we haven't covered in the lecture ourselves. So there and the idea for this mini-seminar would be in the last week of the semester, which is week 30. We would, instead of performing our tutorial, we would meet and hold mini-seminars. These are 15-minute talks. Don't perform, add any introduction. Just dive in right into your topic and explain the algorithm or approach that this particular topic is all about. And you're fine with that. You should hand in the references that you used together with the slides that you are planning to show a week earlier than that to Rafaela and me, and so that we have a kind of a last-minute chance to steer you into the right direction in case that this goes horribly wrong. Yeah, that's about it. So maybe a little bit on the topics themselves. So since we have now done lexical and syntactical analysis, the topics here are mainly from this area, so that you have some kind of background already. So the first one would be to prepare an introduction into the approach of writing a parser with so-called parser combinators. People who are more into functional programming have probably already heard about that, or maybe even written a parser themselves of such a concept. So this would be topic number one. Present the general concept of how to do a parser combinators, and maybe add a little bit of example to that to illustrate what this topic is all about. Second one, parsing expression grammars and packrat parsers. So parsing expression grammars are one idea of getting rid of a lot of non-determinism by not having non-deterministic choice, but instead having the alternatives of a productions for a particular non-terminal being priority. Well, priorities for each of these variants. And with that, you can set up systems that are, well, quite decent in terms of useful for particular programming language already. And one way of implementing parsers for that would be the packrat parsers. And yeah, well, this topic would be about presenting the approach of parsing expression grammars together with their implementations by the means of those packrat parsers. Next thing would be, well, we have just recently heard about those fellows. LALRK is one special class of LRK parsers that tries to not have a state explosion and still have meaningful results on particular languages. And yeah, this goes by this works by abstracting away from a few disambiguations that the LRK parser does and joining particular states in case that their LR0 core is the same. And I would like you to present what this LALRK is all about. Next thing, pages, LRK. This is a topic of, well, LRK parsing, where the K is not a fixed K anymore, but is enlarged by demand. So if certain fractions of your grammar enforce more look ahead than others, then this in this approach those states are outfitted with more look ahead than maybe others. So this gives rise to a whole new class of parsers, and you are there to present the approach and the realization of pages LRK. Next thing would be generalized LR, or also called Tomita parsers, which is a concept that goes beyond the deterministic context-free languages. Those parsers here, well, drop the strict performance constraints that we had on with LL and LR parsing to the benefit of being able to parse more than just context-free languages. So there are certain context-sensitive properties in those languages too, which is quite a handy thing to have, particularly in areas where context plays a large role, like I think even natural language processing. But yeah, I'm not so knowledgeable about this particular thing. So well, that's for you to present. So the approach and the realization in terms of how this works internally of these Tomita parsers. Next topic, six, well, maybe even seven. Those are two approaches that are alternatives to this Berisethi construction that we had for turning regular expressions into decent finite automata. And those two constructions promise a lot smaller results than the Berisethi approach would provide. However, they work a little bit differently, don't follow this idea of attribute systems that this Berisethi approach has. So this is why we didn't choose them in the lecture themselves. But for this mini-seminar, this is probably a decent topic to work on. So it's a nice little automaton construction from regular expressions. Next one is back to the topic of parsing. This would be LL star and LL regular grammars. So I don't know whether, in case that you have already had a little bit of contact to compiler construction, there's this famous this famous parser generator out there that is called Antler, like this. And although the name supposes that this would be an LR parser generator, it's actually not. It's an LL parser generator. And it follows the idea of LL star or LL regular grammars. And the idea behind that is that you specify LL grammars with a look ahead, not being an actual fixed sequence of characters, but instead you can use regular expressions or even automata as look ahead specifications. So this is about this antler thing. Then the next semi-decision procedures for grammar uniqueness. So specifying a unique grammar is maybe quite a nice thing to have, because otherwise your parser generator will just spit out a lot of reduce, shift reduce, and whatever conflicts that there are. So getting a certificate that your grammar is actually already in a unique state before putting it into a parser generator would probably be a nice idea. This would will help you in just concentrating on those shift reduce or reduce reduce conflicts that are not due to ambiguous grammars, but on just having not optimally written productions. So these are the things that are due to just unique grammars. Those can be mitigated with this LRK to LR1 construction, for example. So we haven't talked about that. Deciding grammar uniqueness in general is an undecidable problem. However, there is semi-decision procedures for that, and I would like to know about that. So I would like to have one or two of these approaches being presented in this mini-talk. Next thing is island grammars. So this is covering the area of well, situations where you don't need the complete grammar of a thing that you're interested in, but instead are just interested in a fraction of grammars and can already work with that. So this seems odd and interesting, and I'd like to learn more about that. So you are there to present this kind of interesting topic. Then, thinking about reverse engineering grammars, you could wonder whether there is anything out there that would be able to kind of learn the context-free grammars for particular inputs given enough input. And there is concepts out there for learning grammars for input, and well, they are largely overlapping with the topic of data compression. So there are approaches like this LZW, which you might already know from the area of this data compression and this sequitur. And yeah, I would like to learn about how to apply these kinds of algorithms in this setting. Number 12 is first K and follow K. So in our lecture, we had the specialized algorithms for first one and follow one based on a specialized graph algorithm, but we haven't talked a lot about how to generally implement systems that will give you first K and follow K. So this is to do with constraint solving on inequality systems, and how to do that for the purpose of this first K and follow K would be the topic of number 12. Then the next three ones are usually a little bit related to practical systems out there. So there's this reference attribute grammars topic with the tool just add. So this covers what we're gonna see in right the next half an hour with semantic analysis. This would be attribute grammars of a particular kind. Then there's the idea of extensible grammars with PBG. So this is about evolving language specifications. So languages evolve over time. There's version 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 for particular languages, and they might incorporate changes to the grammars. And from a software engineering point of view, you might like to not develop completely different parsers or compilers for each of these versions of languages, but you would rather like to have a common front end where you could just specify, well, this is part of that version of the grammar, and we can extend that by this and this to cover the next version of the grammar, and this is what this extensible grammars with PPG does. Yeah, and well, then at last there's this kind of all-round topic on just language processing with Chiama and Scala, which covers the whole process of, lexical, syntactical, semantical analysis together with code generation in one large package, which is this Chiama approach. And for people who like Scala, this might be an interesting thing to do. So, that is the topics that are out there. I'm ready to take your choices here. So, is there interest in one of those? Yes?
In 15.
You want to do Chiama Scala? Are you somehow... Do you know Scala?
No, but I'd like to.
Yeah, so, well, just a word of warning, if you don't like functional programming, this is maybe not a nice thing for you, mm-hmm. but if you are not afraid of that, as you probably should be when you do compiler construction, then, this... it's kind of an integrated approach with probably a lot of these attribute grammars in there, but it would be interesting to see what this offers. Yeah. Okay, so should I put down your name or initials for that?
Laura for LL.
So I just put Laura there. Okay. One person. If you like a topic for two, you can, for example, do Follow and Antimirov. I think they complement each other quite well. Yeah, so?
What?
MT? Like this?
Yes.
Okay. Well, let's just. Well, there's more topics than interested people, so we can still switch around. So. You would like to do the follow automata?
A.
What?
A
H.
A
H. Then there was you.
I think? Was interested in that as well, but I guess maybe semi-decision procedures for grammar unit mismatches.
Okay. So, which one would be that?
I mean, I can't also do the automata, right?
No, it's just for one.
Yeah, so I'll just do semi decision procedures programming.
Okay.
What do you want to
initials?
Is it difficult? LT, sorry.
LT, like this?
Yeah.
Okay. It's just 15 minutes, so you can't go into the very, very difficult parts anyway, if there are any. So I don't actually really know so much about this particular thing, so let's see. But there's papers about that, and you can ask Rafaela. She has a few references for that. Yes?
Can I also follow
which number was it?
12.
This one? Okay. And the AB? Okay, so
there's one topic that I would like to present, but that's on the list, which is early parsers. Can I do that?
Early, like this?
Yes. LA was EY. It's a parser for parsing every context-free grammar that gives linear runtime for deterministic grammars and cubic runtime for...
Okay, this sounds compatible to the topics here. I didn't get the
E A R L E Y.
Sorry, I have to remember. E A R
L E Y.
Ah, so it was just missing an E. Okay. So your initials?
PK.
PK, why not? So then. LALRK? So, like this? Okay. So.
I was interested in doing the pager setting, LRK.
Mm-hmm.
SK.
I'm not sure whether one finds the references for that immediately from just pages, LRK. Pager is the author of a few top... papers in there. Maybe DBLP will help you in locating these things. It should be like two or three papers on that area, and yeah, that would be the entry into that.
I think I can do number 10.
Number 10? This would be?
CC?
Yeah. Like this?
Yeah.
Okay.
Topic number 5.
MZ?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Another letter.
ZI.
Okay. Good. Ah, I completely overlooked you. Wow. Yeah, well, it's probably. Yeah, so. MS? FS. Oh. 40. Which initials? Like this? Okay. So there's just LZV, reference grammars, and PEG and LLstar. But seems that you're kind of satisfied? Yeah? Okay. So, since this is on the recording, this is fixed now. So, yeah, if you have trouble finding exactly what I meant with these topics, then just ask us again what this actually really meant or what we were going for, or we might even adapt it a little bit so that there's more material to work with, but this is kind of the starting idea. The topics are going to be presented in this week 30. There's the Monday and the, I think, Wednesday arrangements for tutorials. This would be the slots for these presentations then. Each of them is around 15 minutes, and in the week before, I would like to see a little bit of what this direction goes into, so slides and references that you used would be nice to see, so that we can prevent you from hitting any wall that would be there. Yes, so that is that. So there are a few still remaining. If you decide to rather like to have one of the others, contact me, first come, first serve. And I think that's that. Is there any questions on this? No? Okay. So let's move on. semantic analysis. So we are now leaving the area of syntactic analysis. So we have seen that there's this LLK and LRK parsers, and each of them would at some point decide upon either an expansion or a reduction being related to the reconstruction of syntax tree. So what each of these things would usually do is they would offer you hooks for where you can plug your own code into. So each time that the parser performs a reduction, for example, it would call code from the user, and that would be the place where you can build up a syntax tree, for example. So you would specify your grammar, and for each of the productions, you would provide a callback function that would create some structure or object representation of the of this piece of syntax that the parser has detected at that point. And this would step by step assemble a complete syntax tree for you. And this syntax tree is now the point where the semantic analysis continues with. So, yeah. Now that we have scanner and parser covered, we can look back to our original purpose of accepting programs of a particular kind. And the thing is that after the scanning and parsing phases are done accepting, you can be at least be assured that the input that you gave it has the correct syntax for that particular language. This still doesn't mean that the program that has been specified there is actually correct in any way, or that it even makes sense. So there are syntactically correct programs that, that don't make any sense. So this is why usually to save people from weird runtime errors, you still continue on analyzing the input that you have during compilation and try to recognize some of the programs that don't make any sense. And those programs are then either rejected or reported as erroneous. And what is erroneous for those languages is actually up to the to what language we're talking about. What typical semantic analysis usually do is, well, a lot of languages have a concept for identifiers and also for declaring that there will be particular identifiers of some sort, and usually those languages define that those identifiers will only be used after they have been introduced with such a declaration, or there might even be concepts of things like scopes that define the lifetime of particular identifiers, and identifiers are only valid to be used within these scopes, for example. The other use might be, for example, type correct usage of values. Just that a variable is introduced doesn't mean that it still makes sense to use it in every place where the syntax lets it be. So you might even want to have restrict identifiers to only places where particular types of identifiers can go to. So type correct use of variables is another thing that is semantic analysis that you might want to do. So, what semantical analysis are also about is you could find possibilities for optimizing the program. You might warn about possibly incorrect programs. You might find, for example, patterns that are a bad style or something like that. All those things would be considered to be semantic analyses. And the way that semantic analyses work for our purposes here is that usually they would attack properties that the pure syntax analysis could not so far, and it does so by introducing particular attributes in the syntax tree that are annotated in these analyses with additional information that the syntactic analysis could not provide. In the first part of this semantic analysis, we now focus on general mechanisms of working with these attributes, which would be attribute grammars, and later we talk about applications for attribute systems. So attribute grammars, they are used for many semantic analysis, as well as you can use them for things like actual code generation. Everything that operates with a syntax tree as input is usually suited for things like attribute grammars. The way that you compute attributes is usually done by kind of by propagating attribute information from particular spots in the syntax tree where this information is created, and then you propagate that along the syntax tree in different routes that depend on the actual nature of the attribute tree. And during the propagation through the tree, when this information passes certain sub-trees, this might lead to computations on these informations. So if during the attribute flow you pass a particular node, you might transform the content of the attributes in order to compute the content of another attribute. And these are in our world usually local computations that are really depending on the type of node that we're usually passing. So with this concept of local computations, you have usually you focus usually on one particular subtree of your syntax tree, and you access information from neighboring nodes and use them to compute new information for the current node or other neighboring nodes. So all that makes up attribute grammar. So attribute grammars are building upon context-free grammars by adding a set of attributes for each non-terminal and terminal, and also local attribute equations, with local meaning that for each type of subtree, you are able to specify different attribute equations that that specify how certain attributes within the structure depend on other attributes. So, So in for such a system to work, you usually need, when you want to evaluate such a local computation, you need that the results for the attributes on which your local computation depends are already present or have already been computed. So they need to have been evaluated. So in order for that to work, the nodes of the syntax tree, and particularly the attributes on those, need to be evaluated in a certain sequence. So for that, usually the syntax tree needs to be, again, visited in a particular sequence. We have seen such systems already working for our application of turning regular expressions into finite automata. There we already had systems of attributes that we attached to syntax trees. This is a syntax tree of a regular expression. And we introduced certain attributes, for example, the empty attribute, and we had sources for information that were, in this case, the leaves. They would provide start information, and then We could perform local computations for each of the other nodes, for example, this alternative node or this concatenation node, that would provide us with the values for the missing attribute nodes. So with that, step by step, we could complete all the values for the empty attributes of the complete syntax tree here. So in order to do that for our empty attribute here, our strategy was to compute that from bottom to top, or also called bottom up, which is the correct term for that. So the implementation strategy was, of course, to add this particular attribute to every node of the syntax tree, and then compute the attributes in a depth-first post-order traversal, where at the leaves we would just collect the values for empty without having to consider any other nodes. And when we then pass any inner nodes, we could just access the values of the children and with that compute the values of the parents. That way of implementing an attribute system is called synthetic attribute system. So for the empty attribute, this will be a synthetic attribute. Whereas there's also other other concepts for computing attributes. This would be, for example, this inherited, when the evaluation of an attribute is propagated downwards in the tree from root to leaf. So there have also been examples for that in the Berry-Sethi automaton, which attribute to remember? That was first, next, last, empty. There was one that was a little bit different than the others. Next it was, I guess. So, yeah, that would be the one. Anyway, turning for this Berry-Sethi algorithm, I didn't want to focus too much at that point on the general ways of setting up attribute systems. We did that in a very intuitive way, I would say, with these equations based on this kind of sub-expressions. There's also a generic way of specifying attributes, which we will now turn to from now on. So in this general attribute systems, we would want to make it very clear whether we talk about or whether we refer to the attributes for parents or for children. So what we will do is we would introduce for generic subtrees, we would introduce that when we talk about some attribute, we would carry with us an index, and the index would be 0 if we talk about the attribute for the root node of the currently focused subtree. And if it, we have a non-zero index, then what we mean is this is the attribute for the, if it is the ith index, it would be the ith child. So that's that. So reformulating the attribute equations from before would lead us to a system like this, where we would specify local computations, meaning computations for each of the node types. So for the leaves, like these ones here, we would specify that the parents attribute would be defined the following way. This is not accessing any other things, so this is just a locally valid right-hand side. Therefore, the alternative, the parents empty, would be child 1 or child 2. For the concatenation, empty would be child 1 and child 2 would contribute to the value for parent. And here for green star, it would just be empty without paying respect to any children's values, and parent for question mark would also be just without any access to the children. So this is how you do that. How you do that in a kind of generic way, instead of here where we had to have these expressions already in there. We do that because it might not be so simple to just talk about these expressions as we have done before, because if you have generic syntax trees, there might be quite complicated productions like these if-then-else statements, for example, for which you don't want to have these longish clauses anymore as labels for indexes. So instead, we talk about about parents and children with indices 0 and non-zero. So these local attribute equations then usually all work together in order to provide a global solution for the complete syntax tree. So usually we will look for some global algorithms that know about the dependencies of the equations to provide such a solution. So in order to come up with such an algorithm, we usually need a sequence in which the nodes of the nodes of each tree are visited. So it's depending on how you have your dependencies in your local computations, this might play a role. Also, it might play a role which attributes to actually really compute first, because one of them might provide a new value for another attribute's dependency. So it might play a role which of the computations you do first. So the general evaluation strategy has to be somewhat compatible with the dependencies between the attributes. So in order to come up with something that we can really work with, we would like to formalize the dependencies that appear within subtrees of the syntax tree. So let's for that purpose, we introduce the concept of the local dependency graph that is built up for particular productions. So for example here in the production of alternatives, which would have some left hand side and two variants N1 and N2, the empty attribute dependencies would look like empty of the children is something that empty of a parent is depending on. So the local dependency graph would look like empty of parent is depending on empty of children. And in our formalization, this would read the following way. So this is just a representation of the arrows that we find in there with our notation of the attributes in our new form. So we then record with that the local dependencies of particular computations local to subtree of our syntax tree. So however, this is not enough in order to come up with an evaluation tree, because with an evaluation strategy, because the evaluation strategy has also taken into account that these subtrees connect to each other, and thus there might be dependencies between attributes in a particular subtree that are not introduced just via local dependencies, but through following dependencies through other subtrees. So this is what we would actually really need to know. The problem is that depending on what the actual input to the grammar was, the syntax tree changes with each of these inputs. So you can't always say that particular dependencies will be fulfilled or not. They change with the actual input of the parser. So, this is quite complex to solve. So the first of all, let's maybe focus a little bit on the several attributes being added to the system. Let's see how that complicates things. So we can, for example, specify empty first and next for regular expressions in one system. So this would look then like this. You would add several computations for each of these node types. So these are the computations for empty, first, and next. And you realize that for the synthetic ones, you would always have the parent reference on the left-hand side, while as for the inherited one, you would have the children's reference on the left-hand side. So I'm just going to be quick, because we have already talked about how empty first and next actually really works. So you can probably figure out these equations quite, or these assignments quite easily by just looking at the slides from before, if you don't remember how that all works. What this creates is certain dependencies between the attributes that have to be captured in the local dependency graphs for each of these subtrees. So, for example, here you have dependencies from the first attributes of the children to the parents. For the other one, there's actually no added dependencies. Then there's this alternative thing, which has is based on these equalities, and they create certain dependencies that you see here, or in the formal version, like this. And by just looking at these things, you can set up these local dependency graphs quite easily yourselves. It's just a matter of, transforming each of these references to attributes into nodes in your dependency graph. And, this you can do for all of the different kinds of subtrees that there are. And you see there's quite interesting dependency graphs that that arise from that. Here, for example, like this one, or even here, where there's some kind of connection over there. So there's all different shapes that can arise from that. So the question would be now, is there some static strategy that you can establish without knowing about the actual instance of your syntax tree that there is, that will be applicable for every situation that there is? So this can only exist if the dependencies between attributes in such a thing are acyclic. If there is any cycle in dependencies in there, you're lost. You can never come up with a general solution for that if your base data types don't follow any restrictive constraints. You need to make sure that statically make sure that the dependencies never have any cycles in there. However, this is a thing that is more complicated than you might imagine. It actually is deterministic exponential time complete to actually check for cyclic dependencies in there. You might ask, exponential algorithm for acyclic dependencies, how can you come up with such a bad complexity? Well, you have to take into consideration that you're not doing an acyclicity test for just one graph, but on a grammar that will produce a lot of different graphs. out there, and you have to make sure that for each of the possible outcomes or instances that you can produce with such a grammar, each of them will have their own graph structure that you might have to cycle check. And yeah, this is why this is so darn expensive. So this will lead to a few escape routes. You could either let the user specify the strategy for each of these systems yourselves, himself, so, or, well, this is just bailing out of the actual real problem. You could try to determine the strategy not statically but dynamically for each of these trees anew, but this might just be quite expensive at runtime. Or you might decide on just providing static evaluation strategies for particular subclasses of attribute grammars. And this is what we're going to see next time with strongly acyclic attribute dependencies. So, thanks for now, and well, have a nice week, and see you next. Is it next week, bank holiday? Then see you in 2 weeks. Okay.